the unnatural history of the city of the book. There's the shifting baseline where each generation thinks that what it experienced in its youth is the normal.
Yeah.
And so you can have these incredible losses of ocean production, and people don't really notice.
Hi, everyone. Sabrina here. That was a clip from the interview you will soon hear featuring Dan Rademacher. Dan Rademacher is the acting, art, and editorial director for Bay Nature magazine, whose purpose is to inspire people to get out and interact with the beautiful natural heritage of the Bay Area. This is BA Biocentropy, the podcast. I believe Dan is on point in his explanation as to what it means to shift environmental baselines. A quote from the same book written by Professor Colum Roberts that is so well written and speaks to low expectations based on social norms of perception is, quote, "Those charged with looking after the oceans set themselves unambitious management targets that simply attempt to arrest declines rather than rebuild to the richer and more productive states that existed in the past. If we are to break out of this spiral of diminishing returns and diminished expectations of the sea, then it is vital that we gain a clearer picture of how things have changed and what has been lost." Quote.
What's funny, because I don't actually write a lot for Bay Nature. I coordinate the work of a lot of other people. I mean, the pieces that I've worked on that I felt... there was one as I was leaving Terrain where I reported on location in Sacramento at a large conference of... there were protesters, and it was sort of industrial ag conference that was happening in the convention center in downtown Sacramento. And that felt fairly urgent, but as far as the stories here, I mean, some of them that I felt most strongly about were the coverage we worked on about the Delta, 2 years ago, and where we're trying to tell the story of, I mean, when I said before, like, stories happening urgently on the ground now. I mean, some of Bay Nature's stuff is more about trying to remind folks of what used to be. And so the Delta, we worked with an artist named Laura Cunningham, who paints pictures of habitats before they got changed.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that reminds me, one of the early pieces we did was a few different pieces that involved Steve Edwards, who's a the guy who runs the, he's about to retire, but he's run the Tilden, the Regional Parks Botanic Garden in Tilden for a long time, and he's a paleobotanist. And one of the pieces that I worked on where he was involved, and then a woman named Bev Ortiz was involved, was a piece about how Native Americans managed the landscape before Europeans arrived. Mm-hmm. And that was an interesting process because... you had different kinds of points of view. Steve takes sort of the 20,000-year view, where there's actually sort of a continuous story of, well, for him, that the amazing thing was that Native peoples were here for 10,000 years, and their presence was consistent with very high levels of biodiversity.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bev's view, and she works much more closely with Native people now, was that the Native people had helped foster or create that biodiversity, and sort of this interesting kind of debate over, you know...
did they help it grow, or was it already here?
Right.
What do you think?
What do I think? I think probably... what I came out of that thinking was that probably it was already here, and... living in a way that's consistent with biodiversity for 10,000 years is an achievement that's not to be underestimated. You know, that it's incredible that they did that. Mm-hmm. And especially when you compare it to the kinds of loss of biodiversity that we've seen over the last, you know, only, 400 years or something like that. So it gave me a perspective on, you know, you don't have to create something in order to do amazing things. If you are able to accommodate it and help it persist, that's good too.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm not sure anyone will ever know. I mean, there's other people who say that the Pleistocene extinction of large mammals was because people showed up.
Tell me, what do you think when I say biocentropy?
Well, I've struggled a little bit with that word, to be honest, trying to figure out what, I mean, I think of trying to come up with a synthesis of the human and the natural. I mean, that would be the main thing, and perhaps different ways that, you know, there's like biomimicry and by, you know, ways that we can learn from natural systems, I mean, actually, I think there's something in the sort of network effects of internet-based stuff that can be seen as potentially similar, or at least we could learn from the ways networks work in the natural world and map that on. So, that's all I got on biocentropy.
Biocentropy is the elevation of living intentional systems. It is the study and practice of aiding life through the intelligence and natural technology of bio and necromass.
I was just reading something last week about how, I forget where it was from, some criticism of environmentalism as it's been, that it's too negative and too focused on loss and things like that. And I think that, you know, it's always, I find it always a challenge, because a lot of the kind of positive environmentalism that you see, at least like pervasive positive environmentalism, sometimes feels like a greenwash, you know. It's like, oh, you just buy this, whatever, this thing or whatever, you know, and then it's okay. But I think it's also true that focusing on the potential for success and life and ongoingness and the future is a lot more compelling and more likely to work than focusing on loss. It's interesting getting back to that guy, Steve Edwards. I mean, that was one of my early experiences at BeNature, was to sort of, few times talking to him, get a sense of the world seen through his eyes. There's something I read about in a book about the oceans. The Unnatural History of the Sea was the book, and it was the shifting baseline where each generation thinks that what it experienced in its youth is the normal.
Yeah.
And so you can have these incredible losses of ocean production, and people don't really notice, because like when I was a kid, there's maybe a 10% loss, but if you do that over 10 generations, then it's 100% loss. And Steve seemed very able to shift his baseline way back, like 5 or 10,000 years. And so when he walked through the landscape, it was like this sort of place of loss, and it was sad. And I couldn't really imagine seeing that way. And I don't think, again, it's not a way that's gonna move a lot of people, because it's pretty off-putting, but it was also sort of humbling to see that. Like, wow, I mean, my experience of floral diversity in a park is very different, because I don't really know, you know, that there used to be, you know, 60 kinds of trees here or something instead of 4.
Right.
So anyway, but I think that, you know, the kinds of work that we're trying to do in terms of telling more and different, as many more different kinds of stories as we can figure out ways to tell, and figuring out ways to help people tell their own stories in different ways. I mean, that's what I'm most excited about, because I think there's a lot of, there's just so many experiences out there that are worth knowing about.
Let's talk about positive and negative environmentalism.
Okay.
So recently I went to an event, and there was a man there, and he is called the bad boy of environmentalism, because he believes in GMOs, right?
Oh, okay.
And he says that environmentalists are a little bit too sensitive, and get with the times.
Michael Schellenberger?
Or, okay. And in it, he was speaking. I happened to walk in late, and he was speaking on what if you could bring mammoths back, or different species from another island that's similar to the ones that were extinct, and therefore reverse extinction. What do you think about that as an environmentalist?
Well,
or a person that's into environmental journalism?
Right.
How would you feel about reverse extinction through the use of genetically modified organisms?
Yeah, it's just, well, and then there's Michael Schellenberger has his whole topic, but I wouldn't be eager to go down that road. I mean, I think that this is the challenge of you know, this particular, I mean, I think there's different brands of positive environmentalism, right?
Right.
I mean, there's, and it, the challenge is, like, for me anyway, is do I want to, do you go with what you think is gonna speak to the largest number of people,
mm-hmm.
or do you go with something that you think is more right? Or are those two different things?
Mm-hmm.
Because I can see, like, so Schellenberger and this kind of de-extinction, but also like geoengineering,
yeah.
like
mm-hmm.
let's seed the clouds with whatever to reverse climate change, or let's, you know, capture methane and put it underground. I mean, I tend to think that most of those things are going to be like, they're eventually you're going to fall to the law of unintended consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Some shit is going to hit the fan sooner or later. And it's sort of like, well, it's sort of like the Green Revolution. I mean, I can't really, I try to be not, I'm not really an absolutist in most regards. Like,
yeah.
I used to cover GMO stuff from an environmental advocacy point of view, and I'm very skeptical. On the other hand, my uncle actually is a seed dealer from Monsanto, and he grows corn on 2,000 acres in the Midwest, and he's a very good person, and he thinks he's doing what he needs to do for the betterment of the world, and it's, you know, it's very dicey to try to decide. And, like, you look at the Green Revolution, and, like, would those people, on the one hand, it was this vast reductive system of, like, all we need is nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, and then you ignore all the other
mm-hmm.
nutrients that you need in the soil, right? So that's the kind of, and then you end up with dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico and blah, 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 whatever, and pesticide-laden agriculture and all kinds of bad stuff. If we hadn't done that, would a bunch of people have starved in India? I don't really know. I never feel quite equipped to do that kind of counterfactual, to say, like, I mean, because that's the claim, right? The positive claim of the Green Revolution is all these people didn't die. So if the alternative was that they would have died, would I want that? Not really. So it's hard to know where the unintended consequences would fall. But I tend to think that, I mean, particularly with de-extinction or cloud seeding, I mean, it just seems so unlikely to not have all kinds of bad consequences that we, I mean, it's just a little bit of hubris, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the thing that I struggle with, particularly with Michael Schellenberger flavor, positive environmentalism. I mean, I think the rise of sharing culture to me is the one thing I can sort of grab onto as, like, okay, this is something that seems to be, it was like on the cover of the frickin' Economist or something.
Right.
That's something that's reaching critical mass across a huge swath of the population and is good. Whereas, like, Michael Schellenberger, I mean, I think he's got some points, but it's very hard for me to imagine, you know, most of the things that he's talking about, nuclear energy, genetically modified organisms, I mean, to me, most of them are just perpetuating these kind of huge-scale, massive, problematic systems that assume that A, we know what to do with nuclear waste for, like, freaking millions of years, and B, we know what's going to happen when, you know, the next round of super weeds evolve, as they inevitably will, and then we can always sort of solve our way out of that. And I don't really have faith in either of those things. It just seems like kicking the can down the road.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about what I was saying. Living intentional systems, expecting to live the next day. And a living intentional system that expects to live the next day, regardless of what kind of condition the body is in, for instance, it will try its best, you know, to make it to the next sunrise. Mm-hmm. And so with that same, you know, Michael Schellenberger way of environmentalism, the planet would keep going regardless of what condition it's in. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't necessarily mean that a living intentional system needs to be healthy to survive. It just needs to survive. But aren't we tired of just surviving? So hence why bioentropy, the elevation of living intentional systems, that's where that comes in, right? Like, you don't want to just survive. You don't want to just be laid out surviving.
I struggle with that, actually. I mean, personally, no, I don't want to just survive. I mean, I tend to think, you know, I struggle sometimes with whether people, are we just, you know, how different are we from other animals that do tend to, you know, I mean, not that other animals don't feel happy, you know, happiness and emotions. There's a lot of research that says they do. As far as like large scale global environmental and population planning and justice and things like that, I mean, you know, I think these are things that are difficult to find expressed in the non-human world in a way that's useful, at least for me. I mean, it's like, you know, you've got population dynamics that people can chart on, you know, islands and stuff like that, where, you know, the prey species expand until they collapse, or the predators show up, or whatever, or they can expand until they starve to death. And, you know, it's like population dynamics can be kind of cruel that way. And, you know, there's definitely days when I feel hopeful and that we're going to figure this out and we're going to work together, and things like sharing and communal good and working for the betterment of the greater, you know, purpose or whatever are going to triumph. And then there's other days when I feel like we're just on a big global J curve, or we're just going to go up and up and up and up until we crash. I don't know. You know, just this morning there was a story on the radio about how it was particularly about environmental communication and gun rights, that if you, for what they said was, for European Americans in particular, if you cast things as for the greater good, that there's a backlash. People are resistant. But if you cast it as personal freedom, then it works. And so this gets into like this question of, do you want to do what works, or do you want to do what you feel like is right? I mean, so like, maybe if you want gun control, you need to cast it as like the personal freedom to walk around and not be shot, as opposed to the greater good of having fewer guns.
Right wording, right?
Right. And so maybe that's, you know, is that all it takes? Like, if you say, like, you know, and there's evidence of that, you know, that freedom from, you know, freedom to breathe clean air and you know, the freedom to move around in your open space, that these are the ways that resonate with people, as opposed to, you know, help other species not die or be healthy. And, you know, of course, as a longtime environmentalist, I'd like to think like, oh, well, we want to help all the different animals and plants survive.
That brings me to another portion of this.
Okay.
You're talking about the wording, freedom.
Right.
And we're talking about the environment. We're talking about people. There is an old story that is still being told to this day, and a teacher by the name of Martin Prechtel, you know him? He is a teacher down in New Mexico, and it turns out that he has a school named Bolodad's Kitchen, and he was a shaman in Guatemala. And now he lives in New Mexico because he had to leave Guatemala, you know. And he talks about the old story of slavery.
Uh-huh.
But not from a sense where we usually talk about it in school, you know. Oh, you know, there was a slave trade and blah, blah, blah. No, he goes way back as to why would anyone think that you could enslave nature and not have to enslave people in order to work with this massive something that you have enslaved. And in so doing, there is like a systematic way of doing so. And even nowadays, you know, they say that it's not dead, it just transforms itself into another, you know, another form. And so we could say the prison industrial complex is a form of slavery. Or we could say that something as simple as a garden is plant slavery, you know? So he talks about it to that extent so that we can, so that people in his class really can understand why our language is the way that we have it. Regarding environmental slavery, have you ever heard of such? And if so, what do you think about it?
Well, the first thing that came to mind, I mean, there's the whole kind of history of dominion over nature in Genesis. My biblical scholarship is very poor, but I mean that was a common thread in certainly in environmental literary criticism that I was in. You know, that was a root of a problem, and then there's the whole Christian stewardship movement that tries to turn it on its head and make it the root of a solution. Mm. That, like, we have responsibility for nature, you know. So environmental slavery. I mean, I guess so. I find that
of water, of air, of soil.
I mean, I think that on the one hand, so there's that history of, you know, this claim of dominion of people over nature in the Christian tradition that is probably at the root of a lot of those problems. I mean, I think that you know, I mean, I guess I'm somewhat hesitant to conclude too much on the basis of my not very good knowledge of true indigenous traditions and things like that. I mean, my impression over the years is that that a lot of them have some sense of both that certain parts, at least, of the environment are provided for them to use, but that there's a reciprocal responsibility of giving back or maintaining or, you know, not using at all, things like that. And I think that, you know, that reciprocity is probably what's absent in a slavery-type relationship, right? Because it's all about
exactly
one direction. Mm-hmm. And we've certainly lost all. I mean, I think that I've struggled over the years with this question of, like, can we have the kinds of reciprocity that you would need at the scale of global culture? Because I think it's very difficult to, you know, on a village level or something like that. It's just that probably our animal senses are much more able to deal with those kinds of equations. Like, okay, we have this much area where we can farm, and we have this much area where we can hunt, and we have these many, you know, the animals seem less common this season, something's wrong, whereas, you know, I can pull out this iPhone, and don't have any idea, really, where most of that stuff came from, how it even came to be, like, who was involved in its creation, under what circumstances. I mean, I could try to read about it, but, you know, that's where you sort of, I feel like you kind of lose the thread. It's, like, impossible to, or I find it very difficult to accommodate. Like, what do I do about that, you know? I mean, probably I shouldn't have this thing. Probably the implications of the whole global manufacturing infrastructure that allows it to exist are not very good. and so then what do you do? I mean, you know, And so I struggle with, because I think a lot of stuff, you know, human institutions probably work better on much smaller scales than we operate on in our current world. And I wonder if, I mean, I have some hope as a tech, as an some, you know, I can't quite give up the tech nerd that the ways people can communicate using modern technology, that you could actually start to recreate some of those smaller scale systems within, you know, without, you know, total return to kind of Neolithic context or something like that. Because I've also found, I mean, like, you know, people who are back to the landers, I mean, I've been inspired, you know, Novella Carpenter, who has a farm in West Oakland, and someone who, you know, she wrote a book, whatever, but she actually interned at Bay Nature, like, in 2004 or something like that, when I was first starting here, and I was struck. She grew up, her dad was a back-to-the-land, her parents were back-to-the-landers in rural Oregon, and I think Washington, something, and, you know, in the sort of 70s tradition of going back to the land and kind of unplugging. And my wife's family did the same thing in West Virginia, and there's a certain there's an attractiveness to that, except that it was like each family somewhat on its own, unless there was some sort of temporary commune system or something like that. And it, for most people, it wasn't sustainable. You know, after 10 or 20 years at most, it was like the pull of modernism and family and other relatives who made other choices was just too much. You know, you couldn't stay in those conditions forever, most people. And then Novella, you know, sort of recreated this new model of urban homesteading that's now, well, I don't know, she created it, but anyway, like, she was one of the early adopters that I knew of, where you can have this kind of urban homesteading system that tries to pull a little bit from the old back to the land movement, but in the context of Oakland, you know, and you can still ride your bike everywhere, and you can still, you know, go to bookstores and cafes and have cultural interchange, but you're also trying to grow a lot of your own food and whatever and figure out those systems. So I find that pretty inspiring.
This has been an interview with Dan Rademacher. He is the editorial and art director of Bay Nature magazine, a local area magazine which aims to inspire folks to explore and preserve the natural heritage and history of the area. You can visit them online at www.baynature.org. The Unnatural History of the Sea, written by Colin Roberts, is the book Dan mentioned. It was first published by Island Press in 2007. I highly recommend you read it.